Before I did my graduate studies in religion, I got my bachelor's degree in business administration. And as a part of my studies in the business realm, I had to take a course called Probability and Statistics. Now, I know some of you have also studied business, and you've also taken a class in probability and statistics, and you, like I, were fascinated by the things that you can place odds on. As one of our assignments in that class, we had to flip a coin 1,000 times. Now, that took a while to do. And the teacher was proving to us that the odds will even out over large numbers, and you'll come up with about a 50-50 ratio of heads and tails if you'll flip a coin long enough. And so we learned all kinds of things in this probability and statistics class. One thing that we learned is that you can very accurately calculate odds for almost everything. That's how insurance companies make money. They know what the odds are. They know how long the average lifespan is, and they know how much to charge for premium, so they end up making more money than is lost by paying out those insurance premiums at the point of death. It's a matter of probability and statistics. Probability can be attached to any event, however improbable that event may be. Did you know that you can actually work out a formula based on the known universe and the number of asteroids that are out there and our location in the universe, and you can put all that into a computation, and you can figure out what the odds are of a meteor striking New York City? Now, I can tell you the odds are not very good. In fact, they're astronomical of a meteor actually striking New York City. You can figure out what the odds are. You can get Brandon back there at the news bureau to give you the odds of a 10-foot snow falling on Springfield, Missouri. Those are not very good odds, but it could happen, you know, in the vast reaches of the imagination, but the odds are just not good. Now, scientists recognize that once odds get high enough, they cross over into what we call the realm of impossibility. You could probably argue a lot of things that could happen, but they never will happen, and most sane people will recognize that it's impossible for these things to happen because the odds are just too great. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, we read that opening verse in the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, this assertion is not just found here in Genesis chapter 1. It's echoed throughout the pages of Scripture. In Psalm 33, we began by reading that verse this morning. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry host by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the water of the sea into jars. He puts the deep into storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the people of the world revere him. For he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. David believed in what he wrote, that God had created the world. David wrote in the 19th Psalm, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. The Apostle John also ascribed creation to God through Jesus. In John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, we read those familiar verses. In the beginning was the Word, and he's speaking of Jesus here as the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he goes on to say, all things were made through him. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. So John very clearly says, it happened through God, and Jesus was an active part in that creation process. Paul, the Apostle Paul, believes in creation. He says in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 16, for by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. There are parts of creation that are just too small for us to see, but the things we can see and even the things we can't see were made by God. Now, this assertion that we find on the pages of Scripture is something that is denied by many in the world in which we live. It's something that is viewed as unacceptable, even repulsive. Thus, the debate, the lively debate that's going on in education circles across our country, ascribing the origin of man to either an evolutionary process or to intelligent design. That's the battle that goes on within our school system. Now, the question is, if God didn't create the world, then how did we all get here? Well, there's one group that will answer very quickly and say it's through evolution. That's how we got here. Evolution is the belief that matter has existed eternally and that somewhere in the deep recesses of the past, some unknown events triggered a series of reactions that began the process which led to the evolution of non-living matter into living matter, and then a continuation to ever more complex forms of life. Now, I'll have to be honest with you. I'm a preacher. I'm not a scientist. And a lot of science is over my head. But one thing I can do and one thing you can do is that we can reason. We do have a brain. And we can evaluate. And I do know something about probability and statistics because I've studied that. And I know what odds are. And so I want to do a little bit of evaluation this morning of these two options here and look at it in terms of the odds. Now, I can't even begin to list all of the things that would be required in order for life to spring spontaneously into being and then to grow into the complexity that we today have as a human body. In order for life to occur in our solar system, the electrical forces must be within a relatively narrow range to permit the formation of the necessary elements of human life. There are nuclear forces that must be at just the correct level in order for human life to occur and to survive. There are things such as the tilt of the earth on its axis. The earth is tilted at 23 degrees on its axis. And if it were not at that exact angle, water vapors would condense at the North Pole and the South Pole, and huge mountains of ice would form there, and human life could no longer exist on our planet. The moon, in its precise distance from the planet Earth, is crucial to our survival. If you change that only by one-fifth of the distance, the tides, if you moved it in closer, the tides would become so great that they would swamp the highest mountains on our Earth. There are all kinds of variables that have to be just exactly right for human life to exist. So to begin human life by accident, through the evolutionary process, the right odds would have to exist in a variety of areas. Now, they would also have to have come into existence in the same geographical area. When you just look at the odds, let's say, okay, the odds are there, and suddenly, in some primordial ooze, life begins. There's some kind of combustion that turns inanimate matter into living matter. And now you have some kind of a living organism that exists in some swamp somewhere on planet Earth. Well, you've got to have another thing occur. In order for the species to propagate and survive, you've got to have a male and a female. You've got to have two come together, and then you have to have life formation in its most primitive forms move on from there. And you're going to need two life forms to spontaneously occur in fairly close proximity. They're going to have to find each other, and then they're going to have some kind of a baby that will eventually mutate progressively into higher and higher forms. And so you begin to factor in the odds. What are the odds that life could occur spontaneously in two places close enough together that these two life forms could get together and that they could then begin to produce? And you're going to have an upwardly complex production generationally through the years. And that in spite of the fact that that has never been observed to occur. You can change things within species, but anytime mutation occurs, think for a moment. Have you ever seen positive mutation occur? Now, there are some toxic streams in our nation, and occasionally you'll find a frog that has an extra leg. I've known farmers who will occasionally have a calf that's born with two heads. Those are mutation. But I think we would all agree that just because you have a calf with two heads doesn't make him a better animal. That's not an advancement in the species. When mutation occurs, it's a negative thing. It causes the species to die out. That individual that's mutated usually doesn't live long. It's not a strong candidate for survival. A frog may have five legs, but that doesn't help him hop any better. In fact, that's going to damage him. Mutation moves downward, not upward. And yet, you're going to have to factor in the odds that over time, mutation occurred again and again and again, and it always was an improvement on the previous generation. Now, some people will argue, well, there is evidence of mutation causing positive improvement in nature. I love grapes, and I love those white grapes, but I hate the seeds in those grapes. Well, there was a fella years ago by the name of Thompson, and he came up with this idea that you could mutate grapes so that they no longer had seeds in them. And voila, here they are, Thompson's seedless grapes. And now you can get a grape and not a seed to be found. That's wonderful. Now I'm going to throw these at anyone that goes to sleep for the rest of my sermon. Now let me ask you, to anyone who would cite that as an example of positive mutation, who is it positive for? Well, it's positive for me because I don't have to crunch down on grape seed. Is it positive for the grape? Go plant a Thompson seedless grape and see what you get. No, you've got to go back to the other farm and go through this selective breeding process. You can improve things within species, and some people will say, you know, you can breed cattle to have more meat on them, and you can do that, but they're still cattle. These are still grapes, even when you mutate them. And I would argue that it's not necessarily better for the species to do that. Years ago, a breed of sheep was developed in Australia, and they had legs that were about half the length of a normal sheep, and yet they had a lot of meat by doing that. Well, and you think, well, there's an example of a favorable mutation. But the problem was that those little short-legged sheep, they couldn't outrun the coyotes. And so it was not favorable for their species. It was favorable for the ones who ate them. So anytime we see mutation in nature, it moves downward. Now, what are the odds that it is going to somewhere, sometime, move upward? Well, then multiply that by all the upward progression that's going to be needing to move from an amoeba all the way up to a complex being like the human. You begin to factor the odds in, and the odds get higher and higher and higher of the likelihood of something like this ever happening. Now, you can, as I said, you can calculate the odds on practically anything. What are the odds that this building and these pews and all this furniture and this carpet and the glass and the window, what are the odds that this occurred by accident? Well, you'd say they're not very good. This morning I talked about that in the early service, and I said, what if a tornado went through a brickyard and this resulted? And Vinton Haskins came to me afterward. He says, no, you can't start with a brickyard. He said, if you're going to parallel that with the accidental evolvement of human life, you start with nothing. What if a tornado came and went through a bunch of mud, and the mud then somehow became brick, and all the mortar somehow was mixed together so that it fell just between every brick as they all came down, somehow being formed in a storm, and this carpet somehow was woven through the winds and fell into place, and trees that were shattered by the storm somehow were sculpted and they fell into place, even with the writing inscribed on each table on both sides. Now let me tell you something. There's not a person alive that would even for a moment entertain the supposition that this building came about by accident. You know what the odds are when it moves into the realm of the impossible? Let me give you this figure and just look at this for a moment. Scientists tell us that once a probability reaches the ratio of 1 in 10 to the 50th, that it has crossed over into the realm of the impossibility. Bobby, show us what that looks like there on the screen. Anything above the probability of 10 to the 50, that's 10 with 50 zeros behind it. One in that number is the odds of the impossible. That's the number that we call infinity. And there's only one chance out of 10 to the 50th of something happening. When it reaches that point, scientists all acknowledge it has crossed over into the realm of the impossible. It just can't happen. You know what the odds are of this? I mean, they're even higher than 1 in 10 to the 50th of this building all spontaneously occurring. And so we would, rightly so, say that could not happen, not in a million years, not in a billion years. Well, when we come to looking at the human body and the complexities of this human body, let me tell you this, there is more complexity in your eye than there is in this entire building. The odds of that having evolved are much higher than this building having to come into place by accident. Look at the next slide there. The probability of producing a human cell by chance is 1 in 10 to the 119,000th. That's 10 with 119,000 zeros behind it. What are the odds of that happening? It can't. It's impossible. If you can't believe that this building could come about by accident, then there is no way that you could believe that the human body came about by accident. You're moving from animate things to something that is a living, breathing, functioning, complex, incredibly complex body. Now, the chance of this building occurring by chance is far greater than for life to have formed on this planet through evolution. Now, what I have told you, scientists will verify. You can talk to anyone who believes in evolution, and they will tell you, yes, you're right. The odds are astronomically high. In fact, they're far beyond what we would call the realm of possibility. And yet, they still hold on to that. And the question, I think, that's so informative is why would someone buy into something that is so absurdly impossible? Well, I believe the reason for that is prejudice. Prejudice against what Scripture says about God. D.M.S. Watson wrote these words. He said, "Evolution is accepted not because it has been observed to occur or because it can be proved by logically coherent evidence to be true, but because the only alternative, which is special creation, is clearly incredible." A scientist will say, who believes in evolution, will say, yes, the odds are impossible for evolution, but for me to accept that is even more impossible. And so they'll choose the incredible odds of that rather than accept what Scripture says. British evolutionist Sir Arthur Keith wrote, "Evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, which is unthinkable." Well, you throw that out and you're left with these crazy odds. If I choose to deny the existence of architects and engineers, then what am I left with? If I say there's no such thing as a builder or an architect or an engineer, how did this building get here? Well, if I deny the ones that built it, then I'm left with the odds of it having happened accidentally. Now, evolution, you may not realize, has spawned some very dangerous philosophies in this world. Evolution has taken God from his rightful place as creator of the universe and has been an impetus for all kinds of godless agendas. It's interesting because Hitler was enamored with evolution and with this whole godless formula. He studied the teachings of Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is the one who first proposed the whole idea of survival of the fittest. And Hitler put it into a political philosophy, and he decided to speed that process of survival of the fittest along by exterminating what he determined were the weaker elements of society and creating a master race. And so you had the Nazi Empire that came about by one who subscribed to this kind of philosophy. Mussolini frequently in his writings and in his speeches quoted Charles Darwin, and he said that the idea of peace was repugnant to the idea of survival of the fittest, and he was for survival of the fittest. He said you need to have wars in order to thin out all the weak members of society, and he introduced fascism to the world. Karl Marx asked Charles Darwin to write the introduction to his seminal work, Das Kapital, since he felt that Darwin had provided the scientific foundation for communism. You know, there was a series that was on the air, and perhaps you saw it, called Evolution. It first went on the air in the year 2000 by Time Life. And in that series, there was a statement that was made by the producers on that PBS series, and they said in that series, all known scientific evidence supports Darwinian evolution, as does virtually every reputable scientist in the world. Well, there was a group of scientists that reacted negatively to that claim. And the next year, they published a page in the scientific journal, The Weekly Standard, and they listed their names underneath a statement that went contrary to that PBS special. And these scientists were not just high school science teachers. They were biologists and chemists and zoologists and physicists and anthropologists and molecular and cell biologists. And they came from prestigious institutions like Cambridge and Stanford and Cornell and Yale and Rutgers, and the list goes on and on. And these men placed their name underneath this statement, and they said, we are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. And they urged their fellow scientists with these words, careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. There are men who laid their names, their credentials, their reputations on the line. They weren't necessarily people who believed in God, although many of them did. But they just said the evidence is not there, folks. Don't buy this thing completely without careful investigation. You know, the truth of the matter is this, and I think we need as Christians to acknowledge this, we cannot witness nor can we reproduce creation. We read about it in this book, but we accept it by faith. But we also need to be encouraged by the fact that neither can the theory of evolution be reproduced or observed. In fact, everything in nature we see today counters that theory of evolution. It too requires faith. There are people in this world who reject this because they cannot tolerate the idea of a God who spoke this world into existence and a God to whom we are accountable. And so they'll take the odds, however great they are. I don't know about you, but I, for one, believe that the measurable evidence falls much more strongly on the side of creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You know, the wonderful part about this story is not only does it tell about the creation, but it also tells about God's love for His creation and about His rescue from the fall and from sin through Jesus Christ, and about the incredible gift that He offered so that we could spend all of eternity with the One who created us. We're going to sing a song of invitation.